This time of year with football happening, we see that oftentimes the teams go in at halftime and the game really hinges on the second half. So often, what happens when the teams come back out and play the second half of the game? In a lot of ways, our lives are like that. That God takes people like you and I, whose lives are often broken, and rebuilds our lives. And it's what happens in the second half of our life that makes all the difference. If we submit to Him, if we place ourselves at His disposal, it's amazing what God is able to do with people like you and I. And a wonderful example of that is found in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the book of Esther. And I'd like to invite your attention to that great lesson and that great book this morning as we think about the principles and the lessons that we can learn from this wonderful story that has been preserved for 2,500 years for us. And it is known and loved by people of all nations throughout the world. The first time Esther is introduced to us in the Bible, and her name also means star, the Bible says that she was a very beautiful young woman. That she was lovely and beautiful of face and form. And by that, the Bible, I think, is saying that she wasn't just pretty, she was stunningly beautiful. And I'm sure if Esther was living today, she would probably have her own TV show. She would probably be in the magazine covers. People would be talking about Ezra. Does Esther look a little thin? Does she have a baby bump? What is she wearing today? What was she wearing at the gala? Everyone would be talking about her. She would be the star. She would be in the news. And that was her name, Star. But what the Bible says about her also is that her life began as an uphill battle. Because her parents had died, she was an orphan, and she had been taken in by her cousin or uncle, depending on how you read the text, Mordecai. That when her parents died, he took her in and raised her up as his own daughter. So she had had some challenges in her life, and yet her story has been preserved for 2,500 years and is known worldwide. So it just shows what God is able to do on the very face of it from a person whose life started out with so much going against her. And when the Bible comes to the real climaxing moment of this story in Esther chapter 4, which I want to thank Roki for reading that text this morning for us. Her uncle Mordecai gave her this great challenge. He said, "Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a moment as this, for such a time as this." And in that statement, which has probably become almost better known than Humphrey Bogart's line, "Here's looking at you, kid," people quote this saying all the time talking about Esther. And it's such a great question. It appeals to the personal destiny, the sense of hope that we all have as human beings, the power of what we can achieve in our life. What is the purpose of our life that God has in mind for us? You have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Because I really believe that deep within each one of us is a desire to experience the purpose and the meaning that is beyond our own ability. That there is some reason that God has put us here in this world. And for us to be able to know that and to carry that purpose out is a longing that we have within our hearts, each one of us, to experience our own personal version of Esther's story and her experience. And so as we study the book of Esther, we really come face to face with our own life story and God's purpose and God's providence in our lives. The book of Esther really does deal with the subject of providence. And providence is God's hand in human history. It is God working behind the scenes in an invisible way to carry out His purpose in human history. We see in the book of Esther one unique characteristic of this book, that nowhere in this book is God's name even mentioned. There's no other book in the Bible that is true. The only book where God is not named, and yet behind every page is God invisibly working out His purpose. So clearly seen here in the book of Esther. Not only is God's name not found, we don't read anything in the book of God's people offering sacrifices, of God's people worshiping, of God's law. Any of these things that we normally expect to find in the pages of Scripture are missing in the book of Esther. And yet God is there, behind the scenes, steering the outcome according to His purpose. Sort of like the great and powerful Oz in The Wizard of Oz, you don't always see what's really going on. But unlike in The Wizard of Oz, God is not a fake. And He is directly involved in our lives, whether we realize it or not. He is there. He is guiding the destiny of His people. But it does raise the question, as we look at the book of Esther, why is the name of God not there? Why doesn't it mention God in this book? And the answer can only be that it's written at a time when God's people were living outside of His will. They had gone into the Babylonian captivity for 70 years. And at the end of that time, God told His people to return. He provided the path for them to return back to the land of Israel. But some of them, apparently a considerable number of them, had become so comfortable living in this foreign culture that was surrounding them that they had no desire to go back to their homeland. They'd become very comfortable living outside the will of God. To the extent that here in this very book, Esther's uncle Mordecai was willing to put her in a morally objectionable situation. To place her at the disposal of the king, that he would take her in and have relationships with her when they were not even yet married. It is a commentary upon where the people of God had come to at this point of time. And yet, even though God's name is not found in the book, God is there. God is working. And it tells us very powerfully, God is working in our lives today. The same God is invisible to us. The book of Hebrews says, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. God is there working in ways that we cannot see. As the story of the book of Esther begins, we see that Queen Vashti is deposed from the throne. She vanishes because the king, Ahasuerus, decided to have a banquet, a great banquet. In fact, he had five banquets that extended over a period of time, invited all the princes and nobles to come to this banquet, and they were, the custom of that society, the men were in one banquet, the women were in a separate banquet. And the men, of course, were all drinking. And one night they were all drunk, and Ahasuerus decided to have his wife come in and display herself in front of the men. And the meaning of that word, it can only suggest the fact that to uncover herself in front of the gaze of all of these men who were drunken. And her response was no. She didn't want to do it. She refused to come in. It's not happening, she said in verse 12 of Ezra chapter 1. Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuch. This enraged the king. The king was very angered. He was furious, and his anger burned within him, and he asked the men, "What are we going to do?" And one of the princes who was there, by the name of Memucan, he had some very well thought out advice that he shared. And in verses 16 through 19, he said, in effect, Queen Vashti has shamed us all. That when this news gets out, and if you, as the king, cannot even control your own wife, what's going to happen to all of our wives? They're going to rise up in rebellion against us. Something has to be done about this. And so King Ahasuerus, in his anger and in his drunken state, banished Vashti from his presence for the rest of his life. And one thing to understand in the book of Esther is that when the king issued a decree, it is irreversible. Well, eventually the banquet was over, and the king's anger subsided, and he sobered up, and he began to realize that he had made a big mistake. It said in chapter 2 and verse 1 that after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. But he cannot reverse that decree. But now he is all alone, he is sort of depressed, realizing that I have disposed of my own beautiful wife. What was I thinking? Well, his advisors, they came up with a plan. They said, look, O king, in chapter 2 and verses 2, let beautiful virgins, young virgins, be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. The thing pleased the king, and he did so. He sort of liked the idea of starring in his own full season of The Bachelor. And so the search was put out throughout the kingdom for all the beautiful young women to come and to go through a period of preparation. And Esther was chosen as part of this decision. We find that there in there was 12 months of preparation, that Esther, as she came in, she made a very good first impression. In chapter 2, verses 8, this this eunuch that was in charge of the women, he took a personal liking to her from the very first meeting. And he began to sort of coach her and groom her as preparing as one of his personal favorites, that how she could approach the king. And so she followed his advice. They did go through this period of about 1 year in preparing. And during that time, they had all of the, you know, the perfumes and fixing their hair and their wardrobe and all of the things, getting ready for them to go in to the king at the appointed time. And when the time came, Esther did exactly as Hegai advised her to do. And she followed up on all the tips that he gave her, knowing what the king liked, what pleased the king. And she went in to the king when it was her time, and the king made his decision in verse 17. And it says there, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Moving on a little forward into the lesson there. I think I have a slide missing here, but in chapter 3, we find the man Haman comes on the scene, evil Haman. He was appointed by the king to a very high position. And Haman, in this new high position that he is appointed to, expected everyone to bow down to him. That when he would go out around through the city, it would be the duty of the servants to bow down in front of Haman. But it said that as he was passing through, there was one man who would not bow to him. That was Mordecai, who was Esther's uncle. Now one thing that I forgot to point out in the, when Esther was going into the king, her uncle Mordecai advised her one thing. He said, do not tell them that you are Jewish. That's just our little secret. So she did that, and the king did not know that she was Jewish. But when Haman was appointed to this high position of the state and the government, then the one man who would not bow to him was Mordecai, her own uncle. So we have a lot of intrigue happening here in the opening chapters of the book. We have the queen is deposed. We have a beautiful young woman chosen secretly out of the Jewish background becoming the queen. We have this evil man with this power-hungry attitude of being appointed to a high position and being refused by Mordecai, and he is so angry that he determines not only to get back at Mordecai, but he wants to have the entire Jewish race annihilated. And the king passes the edict that so will it be done. And the king's decree is irreversible. Mordecai learns of this plot against his people, and he feels a personal responsibility, and he realizes that he needs to appeal to Esther, that she is in a position to be able to help her people. So he sends a message to her that Esther, now is the time for you to tell the king that you are Jewish. I know I told you not to say that, but things have changed. And you're in this position, and God has put you in this position. You have to act on behalf of your people. But Esther responded back, and she said, I'm helpless. What can I do? The king has not shown any interest in me in the last 30 days. And his decree is irreversible. If I go in unto the king without being invited, I'm risking my own life. If he does not raise the scepter, I will be put to death. What can I do? So Esther was in a position now where she has it really good. She has personal servants. She has them taking care of her day in and day out. She doesn't want to risk that. Her uncle is appealing to her. And so that is when he issues this classic statement to her. Who knows but what you have been born. You've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And he finally gets through to her. But in that, he makes this statement. He says, "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." For such a time as this. Such a great statement. And he's saying to her, he said, "Now, if you remain silent, God will find someone else to do what his purpose is." Yes, there's a risk involved. But think of his kingdom. Think of his people. Oh, God has blessed you. He is raising you up to this place. There's a purpose in that. There's a purpose in everything that's happened. You have a responsibility to act for the people, for the kingdom of God. She gets it. Because in verse 16, her final response is, "Go gather all the Jews who are present and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days. My maids and I will fast likewise. So I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." She makes their decision to do what she knows in her heart she needs to do. But that statement applies to each one of us. You have come to the kingdom. You've come to this place in your life for this moment. There's a purpose in all the blessings that God has given you in your life. God has been good to us. He's helped us to come to the place where we are. We're Christians. We're in His family. There's many things happening around us. Has it all just happened so that you can have a comfortable existence? No. God has a plan. He has a purpose. You're here for a reason. You have some responsibility that those blessings that have been given to you, you need to pass them on. You need to use them in the reason God has given them to you, to put them to the proper result and the proper effect. So Esther understands that. And she comes up with her own plan. She wants him to assemble the people for her. This is the wrong slide that somehow got out of place. So her plan is set in motion now, that she would have the people fast and pray for her, and then she's going to go to the king. She's going to take this risk. She's going to throw it all on the line. "I'll go into the king. If he says no, then I will probably die. But if I perish, I perish." She's praying about it for 3 days. And all she can think about, this is a king who has already banished his wife. This is a king that once he says something, it's irreversible. And if he wants the queen to come in, he raises the scepter. If he's not inviting her, he doesn't raise the scepter. And that's it. He got rid of one queen, he can get rid of another one. That wouldn't be any problem for him. So she's thinking all of these thoughts in her mind. But then she goes into the king, unannounced, uninvited, and he raises the scepter. And so she survives. In chapter 5 there in verse 2, it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand, and Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And he asked her, "What is it that I can do for you? What is it that you want?" And she says, "Well, I would like to have invite you and Haman to a banquet at my apartment." And she gives him the time for that. So she leaves and begins preparing for this banquet. But she doesn't understand, she doesn't realize what God is doing at the time behind the scenes. God is at work. And what God is doing is what makes the difference in the outcome of this plot that is unfolding. She doesn't realize that Haman has already built a gallows to hang her uncle Mordecai on. Meanwhile, God begins to work things out. That night, the king cannot sleep. Of all things, you know, for a king to not be able to go to sleep is probably not that unusual. But on this particular night, he can't sleep. So he calls in one of his attendants to begin reading the records for him to help him go to sleep. I mean, you cannot get any more boring than that. Reading the records, that will put him to sleep for sure. But he hears something in that. He hears being read that there was a man who saved his life. That seems kind of important. And so he says, "What did we ever do for that person? What was his name? Oh, Mordecai. What did we ever do for him?" And he said, "Well, nothing. Nothing has ever been done." So the king sleeps on that, and the next morning he calls in Haman. And he says, "Haman, there's something I want to ask you, your advice." He said, "There's someone that we really need to honor here in the kingdom. And what would you propose would be a proper way to honor this person?" Haman is thinking all this while, "He's probably talking about me." So he comes up with a plan, and he is saying, "Well, why don't you have him go through the streets of the city with a parade in his honor, and all the people will bow down before him." The king says, "I like that. It's a good idea. The man's name is Mordecai. And why don't you take care of that for me? I like your idea." Just like that, the tables are now turned on Haman. It's amazing what God is able to do while people are sleeping, or even while they can't go to sleep. God is working things out. And so now the tables are turned, and Haman hears about this, and he goes home, and he is mourning, and he is grieving. "What am I going to do? I'm going to have to lead Mordecai through the streets so that people will bow down to him." But he doesn't have time to actually carry that out, because the banquet time arrives, and it's time for him to go into the banquet with King Ahasuerus and Esther. And in chapter 7 in verse 2, it all comes to a head because Queen Esther is asked by the king, what is it that I can do for you?" And she says, "Well, it's nothing for me, but it's my people. There's a person that has plotted to annihilate, to have all of my people exterminated." And the king says, "Really? That's awful. Who is this person?" And she says, "He's sitting right here at the table." The king looked at Haman, and he is so angry that he has to get up and leave the room to cool down. Meanwhile, Haman is pleading for his life. He gets down on his knees in front of Esther. He's pleading with her for his life. And apparently, you know, he becomes even more aggressive, and suddenly the king walks back into the room, and here is Haman with almost his hands on his wife. And he says, "What is going on? Now, not only are you plotting against the people, you're now got your hands on my own wife here. Get him out of here." And they take him out and hang him on his own gallows. The outcome of the story is that God's people were delivered. Haman is hanged. And God was able to take this situation and completely turn it around so that the outcome was that His people not only were preserved, but His own honor and glory was upheld in the eyes of this pagan society. God worked it out behind the scenes. Invisibly. His name is not even mentioned in the text. And yet God was in control. Just like He was in the case of Joseph in Egypt, who Joseph went down into Egypt and God raised him up to be the governor of the land and delivered His people. God worked it out here in the book of Esther. And God can work it out in your life. If God is so powerful that He could work in this high level of government, control even the outcome of this nation and these evil people who were plotting, there's no question He's able to work it out in your life and my life. But one thing that God is not willing to do is to allow us, He's not willing to bow down to our own self-congratulation. And our own self-centeredness. And our own stardom. That was beginning to go to Esther's head a little bit, it seems, there for a while. Her own stardom. That was her name. And she was beginning to think like she really was a star. Until her cousin, her uncle, reasoned it out with her. "You've been born for such a time as this. You've got to think about the kingdom. Don't think about yourself." And she listened to him. And that changed the course of history as far as her life was concerned. And for 2,500 years, people have read the story of Esther and remembered her with great memories and fondness. God's not impressed when He takes us from the bottom and raises us up to the top. And we take all those blessings and just assume that all that's for me. When it should be, how can this fit into the purpose of God in His kingdom? God has a purpose. He works things out according to His purpose, according to the purposes of His kingdom. He's not going to bow down to our agenda. Our blessings are not just for us. They're for a purpose. They're for God's purpose. Why has He blessed us? Why has He given us all of these advantages that we have? We have so much, and yet we do so little with it oftentimes. So if God can't use you or me for His kingdom, He'll find someone else that will get it done. But we have that opportunity. He's looking not for celebrities, but for servants. He said in Matthew 23 and verse 11, "He who is greatest among you shall be your servant." That's the kind of person He's looking for. Someone that takes the blessings in of God, but then how can I use them for God's glory? To advance the furtherance of His kingdom and His purpose in my life. And when that happens, it's amazing what God can do with nobodies like Esther or you or I. He's powerful. He's at work. He's behind the scenes. But if we're willing to risk it for God, then God is able to take our life and use it to carry out his eventual purpose. Esther got the point. I hope that you and I can get it also. Thank you for your attention. We're going to stand and sing the invitation song that's been selected this morning. If there's one here today that needs to obey the gospel, needs to commit your life to Christ in obedience to the gospel or in restoration of your life to active duty in serving our great God, we invite you to come this morning as we stand together and sing the invitation song.
All to Jesus I surrender.
All to Him.